And we are holding on static phase on the bays, the fourth line of the wide lines. Still in the middle of, we started with a bunch of things that Rava asked Rava Bamari, where is a source in Torah Shabbat for some popular expression or for something that Chazal say is the case, maybe. So, next one. Amalei Rava la Rava Bamari. Menoha Milsi da Amri Inshi. Where do we have a source for this that people say, Chamra Lamore Tivusa Lashafye? The wine belongs to its owner. The good belongs to the one, the good or the favor belongs to the one who serves it. Meaning, there's two different explanations, Rashi and Tosfos. Rashi says it means that you're a guest by somebody's house. The wine belongs to the balabas. But who do you give your thanks to for serving you the wine? You give your thanks to the waiter who brings you the wine.
How does it?
Chamra lamare, the wine belongs to its owner. Tivusa, but that's the next one. You're skipping to the next one.
Okay.
So this is the fourth line of the wide lines. Chamra lamare, tivusa, fifth line now. Tivusa l'shaki, the wine belongs to the master of the house, but the thanks are given to the waiter who serves it, to the one who pours the drinks. Tosfos learns differently. Tosfos says that it means the owner, the master of the house owns the wine, but the waiter is the one who determines how much each person is going to get. Tivusa, in the sense like he's the one who decides how much good, how much to favor each of the guests. Where do we see it? It's a popular expression. It's often brought more in Rashi's sense people say, you know, that I'm giving you credit for bringing this to my attention or making it possible to happen, even though you're not the ultimate cause of it. In Chassidus, actually, it talks about the idea that, we know from the Rambam that was the original idea why people started worshipping Avodah Zarah. They made that mistake. Since Hashem sends down Hashpa to the world through the heavenly bodies and whatnot, therefore we should thank them, like you'd thank the waiter. The difference being, they don't have any independent power of their own, whereas, for example, you have a mitzvah in the Torah to honor your parents, because they do. They have the choice to bring you into the world and to raise you. They have their people, they have the chiruch chapshit, and therefore, tivus al-shakir, therefore, even though your life comes to you from the Eibishter, they deserve the credit. So more often it's brought in Rashi's sense, but they Amalei d'chziv, v'samachta es yadcha olav, we find the Eibishter says to Moshe that you should rest your hand on Yeshua, l'man yishmun v'yiron kol adat v'nei Yisrael, the exact lashon ha'pasuk, but whatever, in order that all the Jewish people should hear, should see what's going on. Uchtiv, but later on it says, v'yeshua b'nun molei muach chachma, ki samach Moshe es yadav olav, Yeshua b'nun was full of a spirit of chachma, because Moshe rested his hands on him, v'yishmu elav kol b'nei Yisrael v'gremer, so the entire Jewish people listened to him. The point being, according to Rashi's way of learning at it is, where did Yeshua's chachma and greatness so forth come from? It came from the Eibishter. But the Pasuk credits it to Moshe as if he did it independently. There's an example of this idea that you credit the waiter rather than the balabas.
That's the right thing to do.
Again, Moshe has the chiruch chapshus. Moshe is a human being. It's an expected thing to do. You know that it comes from the Eibishter, but you also need to give credit to the person who had Bechir Chavshis who made himself a keli for it to happen. According to Tosfos' explanation, rather the point is that the Eibishter had only told Moshe to rest his hand, one hand on Yeshua, and instead Moshe went ahead and rested both his hands and gave him a double measure of greatness and chachma and whatnot, and therefore in Tosfos' sense then, like the Eibishter is the one who owns all the chachma and the greatness and so on and so forth. But it was Moshe, who, so to speak, the waiter, who decided how much to bestow upon Yeshua.
Even the Eibishter told him put one hand.
The Eibishter put one hand, and he was more generous even than that, and put both hands.
It's what the Eibishter didn't want him to do.
No, it's not that the Eibishter didn't want him to put both hands. It's the Eibishter said, you have to put one hand on him. You want to do more than that, and give him to hey, like when you have, again, like when you have somebody serving drinks in your house, your job is to serve the drinks. You want to serve. You want to serve somebody extra. Give them to him. Amalei Rava l'Rava Bamari, Menoha Milsi d'Amri Inshi, where do we have a source for this that people say? Kalba b'kafne, when a dog is hungry, Galilei Nivla, it'll even swallow Galilei. Now Galilei, Rashi says, has two meanings. We learned all the way back at the beginning of the Masechta, Kasha Yivara Golol Atumai, that Golol can mean some type of stone, like marble or whatever. So therefore, in that case, the expression would be, when a dog is hungry, he'll even swallow rocks, like something that's totally inedible. Rashi brings a second explanation that maybe glolim means excrement. The problem with that, Rashi says, is that's not just when a dog is hungry. The dogs eat that kind of thing all the time. So you can't really say only when he's hungry. Yeah, they find it on the street and they eat it. Maybe not nowadays that people keep them as pets and feed them properly, but we're talking back in the old days, you know, we're talking feral dogs basically. Anyway. So where's the source in Torah for this concept? That a dog when it's hungry will eat even something that it wouldn't normally be expected to eat. By the way, it's brought from the Vilna Gaon, a practical outcome of that halacha. We learned earlier in the Masechta that if an animal eats something that's not normal for it to eat, it's considered a tolda of keren, and you'll pay chatzi nezek. Based on what we're saying over here, it comes out, according to Rashi's and Rabbeim's explanation, it's normal enough for a dog to eat rocks when it's hungry. Therefore, if a person has rocks prepared for building or whatever, and somebody's dog comes and eats them, it would have to be considered nezek shalom. It would be considered a tolda of shame. Anyway. Where is the source for it in the Torah? He says, "Dichtiv nefesh sveya tavus nefesh, a satisfied soul, a satisfied person will trample all over nefesh, delicious stuff. But nefesh re'eva, but a soul that's hungry, kol mar masik, anything that's normally bitter would be sweet to it. So we see, like the dog will even eat something that's inedible." Well, first, I'm also say the point of it is, as a Musudika thing, if you see, for example, a guest in your house or at a simcha or whatever is eating ravenously, you know, don't think badly of him. He may possibly be hungry. You know, he'll eat anything that he sees. Omalei Rav Rabba Bamori. Next one. Menoham Milti Damri Inchi. Netayo Va'ozo Dikla Bisha Gabekina Desarchi. The bad palm tree, like a palm tree that produces bad fruit, likes to walk along with the infertile trees. Kinnah d'Sarchi, Rashi and Tosfos discuss the details, how exactly Sarchi comes to mean infertile, but that's basically the idea of it. Trees that don't produce fruit. So, like, in other words, the point of the mashal is that a bad palm tree usually tends to grow next to trees that don't produce fruit at all. Where's the source for that? In other words, it's kind of like birds of a feather flock together. We have this written in Chumash, repeated in Nevi'im, repeated a third time in Ksuvim, and we have a Mishnah that expresses this idea, and we have a Braisa that we learn the same concept, that light goes with light, that the bad tends to stick with the bad. Where's in the Torah? Kosav Torah, Esav Yishmael. It says that Esav went to Yishmael to find a wife. So like the two no good nicks come to join up with each other. Yishmael did tshuva, fine, but still, you know, because this actually happened right before Yishmael died. That's Rashi explains over there on the pasuk the reason why the Torah tells us how long Yishmael lived and is to teach us the Seder Advarim that this happened at the shortly before Yishmael died. Asa went and got engaged to his daughter. Rav Levi Bornstein, when he was my seventh grade Rebbe, and we learned this in Yeshiva, said maybe what happened is Yishmael realized what kind of a son-in-law he's getting, and he had a heart attack. Anyway, the point is, okay, so Yishmael had done sugar, but still, you know, Yishmael came from a bad source. He came from Hagar. Marshall explains that that's the point of the metaphor. He came from Abram, but he came from Hagar as opposed to Esav. In other words, that's Marshall explained. The point of the thing is Esav at least came from a good background. His parents are Yitzchak and Rivka. Yishmael came from not such a good background. His mother was Hagar. So therefore,
it's Avram married Hagar.
Okay, fine. But the fact of the matter is, she's still not on that level. So therefore, she was a daughter of Paro, right? So the point is, therefore, so Esav is compared to the bad palm tree, who goes to the barren tree. Shani b'Nevi'im. It's repeated in Nevi'im. D'chtiv vayislakto yiftach hanoshim reikim vayiyu vayetsu imoy. It says that they're gathered together to Yiftach after he'd been kicked out of his house. They're gathered together, empty people, and they went out on battles with him. So we see Rabbi Yaakov Emden points out the word imoy shows that they were the life attracted to life. They were empty people, so they were attracted to him, an empty kind of guy.
So what is up on Marion?
No. This is Yiftach we're talking about. No, yeah. No, she had Milus after all. I mean, the Medrash says, you know, you look at the difference, you know, later on in Tanakh, you find, you know, Shimshon's parents, Gideon, see one Malach and they're terror stricken, we're going to die. Hagar sees four malachim one after the other, because each malach in Parshat Lech Lecha, when she's having a conversation, where he tells her to go back home and submit yourself to Sarah, and you're going to have a son, and he's going to be a wild man, etc. Each message was delivered by a different malach. So she sees four malachim one after the other, and she's fine. Yeah, so she had a certain madrega, but still, yeah. Okay. Anyway, so that's Yifta. It's repeated a third time in Ksuvim. As it says, every bird lives with its own kind. And people tend to stick life with life. Now, this is not actually a pasuk anywhere in Tanakh. So Tosfos says, maybe it comes from Sefer Ben Sira. Sefer Ben Sira is a sefer that was written, I think we've talked about it before briefly, it was written during the time of the second Beis Hamikdash. The author was actually a grandson of Yirmiyahu. He wrote it much in the.
They wanted to make it a.
I don't think they ever. I don't think that the Gemara discusses in Sanhedrin that actually you're not allowed to learn from it because there are silly, foolish things in it and it'll lead you the wrong way. But Rabbi Yosef says over there in the Gemara, there are good points in it, and those you're allowed to darshan. This is one of those good points.
What is it, foolish
things? The Gemara brings an example over there. We'll learn when we get to Sanhedrin. We'll learn about it, Bez Hashem. But also go Vaster. But yes, there's a number of places. There's a number of places in Shas where it brings quotations from Ben Sira. This is the only one, as far as I know, where it treats it as if it's literally a pasuk from Ksuvim. No, not the only one where it treats it positively, but the only one in which it treats it almost like an honorary member of Ksuvim. I don't think there was ever any Havam in it to have it in Ksuvim, but I don't know. The fact of the matter is it wasn't written with Ruach HaKodesh, so it never made it into Snap. Anyway. With that said, though, Maharal wants to say that maybe not necessarily from Sefer Ben Sira. As a matter of fact, they did. They found manuscripts of Ben Sira in the Cairo Geniza. They found a similar pasuk in there. But the Maharal argues it could come from the many Sfarim that have been lost over time. Maybe this comes from one of them. Anyway. Okay, Tanan B'Masnissin, he says we learn in a Mishnah this concept that a bad thing goes with a bad thing. Kolamachuber l'tomei tomei, kolamachuber l'tahar tahar. Anything that's attached to something that's tomei, meaning it's able to be makabel tumah, itself can become tomei, and anything that's attached to something that is tahar, that cannot be makabel tumah, remains tahar. The Rashi gives an example that, for example, a hook, let's say you have a metal hook. It actually describes it as shaped more like a fork sort of used to hang things on. If you attach it, let's say to a table, which a table is able to be makabel tuma, then the hook is also able to be makabel tuma. But if you attach it, let's say, to a menorah, which is a pshute kleit, it's a flat wooden vessel, it's not capable of being makabel tuma, whereas we're talking about this menorah is basically just a stand for a lamp, then the hook is not makabel tuma either. So you see, because it's attached to something that's able to be makabel tuma, therefore it is
not. A table that's not made of wood.
No, perhaps just even a table that's made of wood, because it you use it to put things on, you use it to put the dishes on, etc., therefore it's makabel tuma. The Goinim give other examples. It also has to do with the material they're made out of. Stoneware, for example, can't be makabel tuma. Wood and metal and whatever can. So if you have something, if you have, for example, metal attached to stone, then it won't be makabel tuma, etc. What's not at end, the Tanina b'Braisa, and we learn a Braisa that expresses this idea. Rabbi Eliezer, loy lachinam holach zarzir eitzel erev. It's not for nothing that the zarzir, in English, called a starling, it's a type of bird. Hangs out with the ore, with the raven, elevat nesho mino, it's because it's part of the same species. In other words, Rabbi Eliezer is saying the fact that starlings and ravens tend to live together means that we know a raven is a traitor bird, it's listed in the Torah, it's called ore of the mino, so is the zarzir, because it hangs around with the starling, because it hangs around with the ore. So we see again that that bad things tend to stick together.
The line begins.
If you call your friend, meaning Rashi says you call him, you're trying to give him mutter, you're trying to give him teichecha, and he didn't answer you, Rami Guda Rabba, throw a big wall, shoddy bay, and throw it at him. It doesn't literally mean to throw a wall on him. Rashi says it's an expression meaning that would let him be, fine, let him destroy himself with it. You push him away from you, that he shouldn't have anything to do with you, and let him destroy himself with his rishis.
What do you say, yes, thank you, you're right, or just you suppose it depends on him?
It sounds like, in other words, we're talking about you have justified reason to criticize him. He should be accepting it. He didn't listen. He's still doing the same bad thing. So therefore, Rashi says it means wash your hands of him, basically. Let him continue in his bad ways, and he'll end up getting destroyed by that. But the Gemara in Erchin does say there's a limit to it. Once the person is cursing you or hitting you or whatever, that's the kind of thing we're talking about over here.
Okay, we're just saying he doesn't listen to you.
No, it means more than that. And actually, by the way, the Gaonim, the Rapatoi Gaon, one of the Gaonim from the middle of the Gaonim, and a number of Rishonim follow him, say that there's also another meaning to it. It means if you called your friend, as in you summoned him for a case in Beis Din, and he doesn't want to listen to the summons, then you're allowed to involve the big wall, meaning the Goyish Accord. And this, therefore, is the source for the concept that if you are trying to sue a fellow Yid in Beis Din, which you're supposed to do to begin with, you don't want to go to a Goyish Accord. But then he doesn't want to pay attention, he doesn't want to come to Beis Din, then you have the right to appeal to the Goyish Accord.
You don't need to go to the Beis Din to ask permission.
You're supposed to go to the Beis Din to ask permission first, just as a matter of derech eretz for the rabbanim, for the Torah. But yeah, okay. Anyway, where do we get this from? Amalei says, because the pasuk says in Yechezkel, Yan ki artich v'loy tahart, since I've tried to cleanse you, Jewish people, and you haven't been cleansed, mitumosech lo titari oid, you're not going to end up becoming tahor from your tumah until drastic things happen. We see, in other words, that they don't want to listen, and therefore drastic measures have to be taken. Where's the source for this that people say? A well that you drank from. Don't throw a clod of dirt into it. Meaning, in other words, in a more general sense, it actually says something that you once needed. Well, not just don't spit in food, but something that you once had a need for. Don't treat it disrespectfully later. This is the famous thing, for example, why Moshe didn't hit the sand to start Makas Kinim or the Nile to start Makas Damim Tzvadeya. I'm a little bit, because you have the politics that says, don't abhor the Adomim, as to never allow them into the Jewish people, because they're your brother. Even though they treated you poorly, remember they are, after all, the brother of Yaakov. And don't abhor the Mitzrayim because you were a stranger in their land. Meaning, in other words, again, they treated you very badly. Nevertheless, though, the fact of the matter is, when you were in a desperate situation, when the famine was going on in Yosef's time, they gave you hospitality. And therefore, remember that.
So if
they become a ger, therefore, the pasuk continues that the third generation Mitzri or Domi is allowed to fully intermarry into the Jewish people.
Well,
the Pashtas only when they're in the sky here, but still, It's brought, by the way, Shitim Okubetis brings an interesting story with the Rif in this connection. One time, the Rif wasn't feeling well. There was a person in his kahila who had a private bathhouse in his house, and he allowed the Rif to use it for a while to recover from his illness or whatever. Later on, this guy became poor. His creditors are taking away his various assets from him to pay off his debt. One of them was going to be this bathhouse. The Rif recused himself from sitting in judgment on it. He said, since I had benefit from this bathhouse, I don't want to sit in a din Torah over it. That's an example of this, that even an inanimate object, don't treat it disrespectfully. People say, if you're willing to pick up the load with me, then I'll lift it up. And if not, I'm not willing to lift it up. Meaning, we're not talking about physical burdens. Rashi explains that, for example, a person might say, this is a risky investment. I don't want to get into it on my own. If you're willing to partner with me, then I'm willing to make the investment. Where's a source for that? Where's an example of that in the Torah? I'm like this, because you have the pasuk, Vayomer Elei Barak. Barak says to Zvora, when she tells him, raise an army and go fight against Sisra. He says, Im telchi imi v'halachti, if you go with me, then I'll go. V'im lo telchi imi lo yelech, and if you don't go with me, I won't go. The point being, especially the point is, it's not like she's specifically going to contribute to the victory. Women don't fight in the army. And anyway, already she had told him in Nevuah that you're going to beat them. But nevertheless, he's saying, I want you along like for moral support, kind of. Similar idea then. Next, Amalei Rav L'Rabba Bamori, Menoha Milsi Damri, and she kad havenan zutri legavri. When we were young, we were considered important like old people. Hashta, the Kashishna, now that we're old, Ladardiki, we're considered
yeah,
lowly, like young people, like children. Ladardiki means children. Amalei Meikratziv, because you see an example, at the beginning, when the Yidden first left Mitzrayim, it says, V'Hashem ho'lech l'fneim yomam ba'amud anam l'anchosim aderach v'layla ba'amud esh l'ahorlehem, that Hashem himself, Kaviyahu, went before them in a pillar of cloud to lead them on the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give light for them. So the Eibishter himself, later on, after the Chet Ha'egel, the Eibishter says, Hina nechi shaleach malach l'fanecha l'shmerach v'aderach. I will send a malach with you. So like they're sort of down, as they get older, they sort of get downgraded. So instead of having the Eibishter himself, they have a malach.
First they had
the Eibishter himself, and now they're downgraded to a malach. There's a sikha that everyone's talked about this one year, Yurtas Kislev, and there's actually a similar idea brought in a number of Maimarim from previous Rebbeim, the idea being that when a person is young, they're more apt to have a sense of Kabbalah so. When a person feels themselves as young and not yet so important, that's when the Eibishter treats them like an adult and like a mature person and like someone deserving of respect because they have bittul. When a person feels himself to kashishna, look, I'm old, I'm respectable, etc., and loses that kabbalah so, then sort of the Eibishter has to take him down a peg because the Eibishter himself is not able to be with there because the Eibishter is only there. The Eibishter's shchina can only be by a person who has bittul. So that's the
and any
v'chuy chalimadur exactly. Yeah. Next, Amalei Rava, the Rava Bamori, the last one. Menaha Milsi Damri Inchi Basa Mori Nichsi Tzivi Meshach. Following the person who has wealth, fat flows after him. In other words, the Marshal explains it's a little bit similar to what we said before: the rich get richer. But this is a little bit different. This isn't the rich person himself. This is by associating with a rich person, some of his wealth rubs off on you, kind of. Sort of like Marsha compares it to a Gemara elsewhere that says if you touch somebody who has his skin smeared with oil, then you yourself get some of the oil on you. So like you associate with a rich person and some of his riches rub off on you. He explains that sivi, he explains, means wealth. There's a different explanation that's brought, I think, from the Bach, that a sivi can also mean wood. So it means do anything you can to associate with a rich person, even if it means hauling a load of wood to him. Anyway.
Sivi is wood,
according to that way of
looking at wood.
Wood in general, just that the Aramaic in a number of places in Gemara you have the word sivi means wood. But Marsha explains
is wood to describe wealth.
If you have a chance, do whatever you can to associate with the wealthy person, even if it means that you're going to have to schlep a load of wood to his house. That's how the Bach explains it. Anyway, Amalei Dichtiv, because you have the pasuk that says Vagam Loi Tahoilachas Avram. Also, Lot, who went along with Avram, he had sheep and cattle and tents. So we see the pasuk makes a point of mentioning that he went with Avram as if to say that the reason why this happened is because he associated with the wealthy Avram and therefore some of it rubbed off on him.
Maybe it wasn't because he was wealthy, but more because he was rich and mercantile.
Fair enough. But so who says? I mean, when we said Basa Mori Nichsi, it can also mean that he has Nechassim in Ruchnius. Whatever. The point is, we want to show a source that this concept exists in the world.
The parallel of saying don't be with people who are bad,
yeah,
because they will take away from
yeah,
you, and now he's saying
yeah,
being with good people.
Exactly. Now, we mentioned earlier at the very beginning of the sugya on Tzadik Beis Amud Aleph the concept that if you daven on behalf of somebody else and you yourself need that same thing, the Eibishter answers you first. We learned that from the story of Avraham and Avimelech. So now comes the flip side of it. Amar Rav Chanan, hamosa din achaveiro, if somebody hands over a din against somebody else to the Eibishter, like he says, Hashem,
punish him.
For what he did, who nanish trila, the person who does that gets punished first. Because, well, one thing is, because he's causing that the Eibishter, first of all, if he's causing that somebody else is getting punished through him, and the Gemara has a very sharp thing to say about that in Shabbos. The Gemara says in Shabbos that somebody who, if somebody else is punished because of you, then you don't get brought into the Eibishter's close mechitza in Elam Haba.
You're going to be Russian.
We're going to say an exception to this in a minute, but wait, let's first bring the basic idea. We're going to qualify it in a second. But there's also the idea, there's also the famous thing, you know, the Baal Shem Tov's famous explanation of Din B'cheshbon, that when the Eibishter wants to judge a person, he first, the Eibishter puts you in a position to pass judgment on him And then, okay, well, you know, you're saying he's a no good, Nick, he did X. So maybe just start investigating, okay, did you also do X maybe in some dachistic way, and therefore, yeah. Okay. Shenemar. Yeah. Vatomer Sarah al Avram Chamasi alecha. We find that Sarah says to Avram after he married Hagar, she told him to marry Hagar. Later on, what happened? Hagar became pregnant, and she started acting in a chutzpahdik way to Sarah. Look at this. All of a sudden, I became pregnant first, and you've been married to Avram for, 50 years or whatever, and you haven't had children. I'm obviously the greater tzedekis than you. She started acting insolently towards her. So Sarah says to Avram, Chamasi alecha, my injustice is on you. And she finishes off in the pasuk, Yishpet Hashem beni yovenecha. Let Hashem judge between me and you. So that she was Moshe Din. Uchtiv, later on, by Yahweh Abraham, Lucifer the servant of Kaisa, that Abraham came to bewail Sarah and to mourn for her and to cry for her because she died first. That was the Nana Shtila. Marsha points out a nuance in it, by the way, that
even
the Nana
Hagar, who was.
Yeah. No. She wasn't Moshe Din on Hagar. She's Moshe Din on Abraham. She's saying, Abraham, you're at fault for allowing this to happen. You should have put Hagar in her place to begin with. Therefore, I'm holding you responsible, and the Abishter should judge you appropriately. So therefore, she and yeah. Marsha points out a nuance in it also. I mean, when you get down to it, it was a punishment for Avraham also. He lost his wife. But she got it first because Avraham didn't find out until later. Only afterwards, after she passed away in Hebron, Vayavai Avraham, then Avraham first came and found that she's dead, listed with the servant of Tosef. So, like, she got it first. Okay, however, what? It was many years later, but okay, we're not saying it happens right away.
Well, you hadn't seen her for so many years.
No. This between the story with Hagar and when she passed away, many years passed. No, he came from the Akedah. She did right. However, this only applies if the victim has recourse down here on earth. In other words, if there's a Beis Din here on earth that he could go to get the matter taken care of, and instead he says, I can't be bothered with Beis Din, I'm going to leave it, I'm going to ask the Eibishter to punish the person, then he deserves punishment. But if he has no recourse, then yeah, you have no recourse, then you appeal to the Eibishter. So Tosfos points out, what was the recourse over here? The Beis Din of Shem existed in those times. Shem was still alive, Shem the son of Noach. She could have gone to him to judge the case. And she didn't. That she's telling Abraham, you should have made sure that Hagar, Hagar's your new wife, fine, but you should have made sure that she still knows her place in this household. He's always asking Hashem to punish his enemies. Fine, he didn't have dinah ba'ara. He didn't have any recourse here on earth. His enemies, for the most part, are Shaul, Achitofel, Doeg, etc. Yeah.
Don't punish
just
that
for
Hashem. Hashem, I can't deal with it. You deal with it.
But
it's mine,
then Hashem. It's a good question. I don't know. Well, hold on. Maybe that's the point of the next piece. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Oylo l'tzoyef yoytzim en anitzak. Woe to the one who cries out to the Eibishter more than the one who's cried against. Same idea. In other words, the one who cries out to the Eibishter to deal with the other guy is going to end up getting the brunt of it first. Yeah. We learn similarly in Braise.
Is that just for a yid, or it's also for a goy?
Doesn't say. I don't know. When it comes to, now the pasuk describes that if you mistreat a yosem or an almana, if they cry out, the Eibush just says, I'll listen to their cry. And the pasuk continues, v'chora api, Rashi brings the pasuk, first Rashi on the Yomud, v'chora api, my anger will flare, v'horagti eschem, v'chora, and I'll kill you, plural, with the sword. So Rashi explains, the you, plural, includes both groups, the one who cried out to the Eibush there, and the one who mistreated them.
So that says the person who cries to the
Eibishter
is going to be killed first.
No, but that's the point. The word eschem includes both of them. Elishem Marin, let's say if Yotzim and Anitzek. But the one who cries out first, like we find by Sarah, is the one who ends up getting the brunt of it first. With that said, though, Tosfos brings a different explanation Tosfos brings a different girsa in the Gemara, which is what the Gemara is saying is that no, when a person does something unjust, whether the victim cries out to the Eibishter or not, either way, that person who acted unjustly will be dealt with by the Eibishter. Don't think, so it's sort of addressed to the victim also. Don't think you have to cry out and bring it to the Eibishter's attention in order for that guy to get punished. He'll get what's coming to him regardless, whether you cry out or not. The Eibishter will do it faster if you cry out, but the Eibishter will take care of it regardless.
Okay.
in Shmos it says Shamati Tzatz Vene Yisrael.
Fine. First of all, remember that again, they didn't have any recourse. That's different. They didn't, you know. And second of all, they weren't crying out that the Eibishter should punish the Mitzrim necessarily, but rather that the Eibishter should help them. Which, by the way, the Ravid says a different point on. The Ravid explains our Gemara in yet a different way than either Rashi or Tosfos. He says the point is, if a person is being persecuted, if a person is in a position where he has to cry out to the Eibishter, he can be crying out for one of two things. He can be crying out that the Eibishter should save him, or that the Eibishter should punish his enemy. You do well, the Gemara is saying, daven for yourself to be saved, and that way you're at least accomplishing something positive rather than that your enemies should be punished.
Why are you complaining about these people?
That's what Tosfos is saying, the point. The Alter Rebbe talks about in Tanya, and again, it's a Kodesh, for example, that if Pliny does something bad to you, ultimately, he was empowered to do it by the Eibishter. The Eibishter wasn't giving chayos to him at that time. He has the chir chokshes. He's still going to be punished for what he did.
He was more of his father than the Eibishter allowed him to.
And there is the famous thing that Ramban and many other Rishonim talk about why, for example, the Eibishter punished the Mitzrim if he told Avraham Avinu that they're going to subjugate the Jewish people. Yeah, there's many different answers. One of them being that they exceeded their mandate. But the point that the Alter Rebbe makes the point in Geras HaKodesh Chopei that regardless, a person can never do anything without the Eibishter giving him chayos at that time. Therefore, in that sense, what are you getting angry at the guy for? He did something wrong and he deserves, he'll get his from the Eibishter.
He exceeded his mandate.
That's fine, but still, even exceeding his mandate, it's still the Eibishter gave him the ability to do it.
Not necessarily.
And necessarily, because otherwise nothing in the world happens without that. That's the whole idea of Hashgacha Pratis. Okay, it's too long to talk about now. But Bechira Chavshit still means the Eibishter knows what's going to happen, but Eibishter's knowledge doesn't compel the person's Bechira. But nevertheless, there's a different aspect, which is the Eibishter controls everything that happens in the world, even the turning of a leaf. Therefore, yes, even no matter how much the person does. Shimi cursing David is the example the Alter Rebbe brings in Tanya over there. If the Eibishter took it, all the Eibishter would have to do is stop sending down to Shimi, the power of speech, and he couldn't say a word.
Right.
So, yes, that's what David says over there in the Pasuk, that Hashem told him to curse. That's what it means. And Hashem told him in the sense Hashem gave him the power to. So therefore, what do I need to be angry at him for? Therefore, what do I need to be angry at him for?
That's a very deep question, because then you can question the Holocaust to the extent that there's no end to it.
Whoa, 1 second. The person who did something wrong still is going to get theirs. Shimi did end up getting his. All David is saying at the time, and what the Alter Rebbe is saying over there, is this person, there's no reason for you to be angry at him, because he's not a fully independent actor. You don't have to be angry at him. Punishment, the Eibishter will deal with punishment. If it's something that can be dealt with, if it's something that can be dealt with by the Beis Din Shel Matza or by the Nuremberg trials or what have you, of course, then that has to be done. That is also true, yeah, indeed. Yeah. Okay. The curse of a simple person should never be a light thing in your eyes. Treat it seriously. Hedyon means a simple person. Like not a great person, in other words.
No, but not a Russia either.
Not necessarily a Russia, yeah, just, yeah. Shari Avimelech killed a Sarah, because we find that Avimelech, after this whole incident with Sarah, cursed her, v'niskayim bezara, and his curse came true on her descendants. Namely, Avimelech says to her, behold, this is for you a covering of eyes, meaning, Amalah, so Rashi and the Pasuk explains a couple of different meanings of it. One is that it should cover over the fact that I humiliated you like this, and, you know, I'm making it up to you, etc. But the Gemara Darshan is that it means, Amalah, since you covered it up, thank you. Since you covered it up from me, you did not reveal that he is your husband, Avram. Therefore, you caused me this whole pain, this whole thing that we had to go through over here, as we learned yesterday. Then it should be the Eibishter's will that you should have children whose eyes are covered up, who are blind. And indeed, even a sky in Bazara, and it happened. It came true in her descendants. Shanem Dichtiv, Vayhiki Zok and Yitzchak, when Yitzchak became old, but his eyes became dim and he couldn't see. Now, that wasn't the only reason. I mean, Rashi on the Pasuk brings up three reasons why Yitzchak became blind. The Medrash brings up a number of others, but they were all contributing factors, in other words. That's true. Thanks. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Are you going to finish the
pack? Yeah, we're going to do it on the base. Why? Yeah. I know. We're going to do Amud Beis as well. We're supposed to be. Okay. Onward. Yeah. By the way, I mean, Mephoshim do say there is, you know, we are talking about where the person has some at least remotely justifiable reason for his curse. Right. I mean, if somebody just walks up to you on the street and curses you, then we're not talking about. So, yeah, that there's no reason to be worried about. In other words, the point is, I mean, Melech sort of has a justifiable reason. After all, the fact is you tricked me and I had to go through all of this. Mashenkin, if he had just, you know, one day they're walking down the street and he hurls a curse at them, that we're not talking about. In that sense, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Omer
Avoh. Because as the Torah said beforehand,
I'm not sure what you're saying, but okay. Let's a person should always be from the pursued and not from the pursuers. Which means, Marshall says one thing, it doesn't mean necessarily don't look to be pursued, don't look to be a doormat. But it means, in other words, stand by the people who are being pursued. Assume that they are the ones in the right and help them out. And then Marshall says a second explanation also. It means, in other words, that if you're the one who's pursued and you have a chance to turn things around on the other guy, and then you're going to be the assailant, the pursuer against him, don't do it. Because after all, you see that among the birds, there's no birds that are more pursued, that are more prey than turtle doves and doves. And those adopted the ones that the turtle set are kosher for carbonus. Similar idea with land animals also, yeah. No, we're not saying turn the other cheek. Again, if you have a chance, be moisedin on a based in Shalmata, or if you can't, then by the based in Shalmaila. But in other words, don't necessarily, according to Marshall's second explanation, don't be minaroidfin, don't seize the opportunity to you yourself be the pursuer. Take on the based in is one thing, but don't do vigilante justice like that. There's a vote that's working the cops here. He says that he says also the point. What do you mean? Of course, if you're a nidif, you're not a roidif. He says don't be a nidif having in mind, well, look, I'm being pursued. Therefore, the Eibishter will end up punishing that guy. Don't do that. Don't be a nidif for the sake of getting the other guy punished.
That's it.
Passive aggression. Okay, going back to the Mishnah said, the Mishnah said that if a person says to another, put out my eye or break my leg or what have you, if the other person does it, he's chayev for the payments, for all the nezek, tzar, etc. And even if he told him, I'm a nas lifter, even if he told him, I'm a nas that you'll be potter. On the other hand, if he tells him, tear my clothes or whatever, I'm a nas lifter, then he's potter. So, Amalet of Asi Bachama the Rabba, Maishna Reisha, Maishna Sefer. What's the logical reason for the difference between the Reisha about injury to his body and the Sefer about injury to his clothes? Amalet Reisha Lefishayin on a Mechel on Rosh Eivarim. Because the difference is, in the Reisha, we can assume a person is not going to be Mechel on the loss of major limbs. So even if a person says, put out my eye, I'm a nas that you're going to be potter, we can't assume that he really means to be moshe for that. He's saying it as an exaggerated thing or whatever, but he still means that he's going to get amalei b'chiyadim moichel al tzair, fine, but is a person moichel on his tzair, on his pain? D'tanya, and in fact, we learn in a b'raisa, that's the question. L'chora, if you're going to say that a person is not moichel on Rosh Eivarim, then by the same logic, a person is not going to be moichel on pain, but we learn in a b'raisa, hakeini tsa'eni amunas lifter, potter. But if he says, hit me or wound me on condition that you'll be potter from any of the payments, then the guy is potter. So what's the difference?
A difference star and Eivarim.
Why would you assume that necessarily there's a difference without some source for it? Yeah. Ishtik. So Rava was quiet. Amma midi shmi alakbaha. So he turns to Rav Asi Bachama. Have you heard anything about this? Amalei hachi amar of sheshit. The difference is mishum pagam mishpacha. The difference is in the Mishnah you can't assume the guy is mochel for a different reason. Fine. If it was a matter of him himself, fine. Maybe he'd even be mochel on Rosh Eivarim. But there's the disgrace to his mishpacha that's involved, which means there's two different possibilities. It can mean his mishpacha is not going to be mochel, that there's going to be a pgam for them, that there's a cripple among in their family, or it can mean that it can mean that they're not going to be mochel, or it can mean he doesn't have the ability to be mochel on behalf of his family, and therefore the guy still remains chayav. As opposed to if he just tells him, hit me or wound me or whatever, there's a pgam mishpacha involved.
Itmar. So now they had a discussion on this between the Amoraim. Rav Oshia Amar Mishum Pagam Mishpacha. Rav Oshia says that the reason why Yochayev in the Mishnah is because of Pagam Mishpacha, like we just said. Rava Amar Mishum Sheinon and Mochel al Rosh Eivarim Shalai. And Rava says the reason is, as we said originally, because the person is not going to be Mochel. Even if he says it, he doesn't mean it. Yeah. So there is a difference. We would say a person is not willing to be Mochel on Rosh Eivarim, but he is willing to be Mochel on Tzar. Which means, by the way, that according to that, it would come out that Rava changed his mind. Before, he didn't think of that distinction, therefore he was quiet. Now he decided that is a valid distinction. Goethe Bach brings a different gear, said that originally the question was asked to Rava, and now we have Rava. So two different Amoraim, so Rava wasn't sure about it, Rava was sure that that's a valid distinction.
Because changes it to Rava.
I don't see that over here, but okay.
Okay.
He said Rava. Okay, fine, fair enough. Okay. Yeah, now goes with your name. Okay, fair enough. Okay. Onward. Okay. Rabbi Yochanan Omar. Rabbi Yochanan says like this. Yesh hein shul kalav, v'yesh lav shul kehein. Sometimes it can happen that a person says a yes, which is the equivalent of a no. Or the other way around. He says a no, which is the equivalent of a yes. Namely, all this time we've been talking about where the person himself, the one who's going to get injured or have something chopped off or whatever, is saying, yeah. Do it, almanach lifter, almanach that you'll be potter. Now we're going to talk about a different angle on it. There can be, Reuven says to Shimon, put out my eye. So Shimon says, will I be potter? And Reuven says, yes. So that's what we're talking about. So now, Rashi learns that the yes or the no over here means there can be a difference whether he says it as a statement or whether he says it as a rhetorical question. So Reuven says, put out my eye. Shimon says, I'm an ass and I'm water. And Reuven says, yeah? Then that's not a yeah. That's a yeah, like, no, of course not. Of course not. Yeah, vitmiya. Tosfos learns differently. Tosfos says that not even if it's not in the form of a question, if a person answers hein under such circumstances, it can still be understood as bitmiya. It can still be yeah, like sort of like you say yeah, like, yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah. And vice versa. Kaninami, how could we learn similarly in Braisa? If a person is sakeni tsaeni amanaslu, if somebody says hit me or wound me, and the other person asks amanaslu, sir, is this on condition that I'll be potter? And he says to him, yes, hariyashen, shen kalav, and this is a hein, this is a yes, which amounts to a no. Again, according to Rashi, it would be he said, yeah, and according to Tosfos, it would be he said, yeah.
Sure.
On the other hand, Kras Sukhdi, what if he says, rip my clothing, and he asks him, I'm an aslifter, is this on condition that I should be potter? Ramale lav, and he says, no. Hare lav, sure, okay, and then it's the other way around, then it can be a lav that's the equivalent of a yes. So in other words, there's no contradiction between the Mishnah and the Braisa, because one's talking about, it all depends how it was phrased. And the Mishnah is talking about that he said a hein, which amounts to a lav. And in the Braisa, it's talking about he said a hein, which is a real hein, where he himself actually said, he himself volunteered, you do this, I'm a nas, that you'll be potter. Not even leaving room for the other guy to ask the question. There is, by the way, a machlokus between the Rambam and the Rosh and various other Rishonim. Everybody agrees that fine, when it comes to eyes or feet or whatever, like it said in the Mishnah, even if he said I'm a nas lifter, you can't be potter, based on our Gemara over here. And on the other hand, with clothing, for sure you'll be potter. What if he tells him akeni tsaeni? That the Gemara is kind of leaving open over here, and therefore akeni tsaeni, hit me or wound me. The Rambam and the Rosh disagree whether the Gemara is ending up saying that you say yes. Does that mean yes, you will be potter, or does it mean like a rhetorical question, like you know, you think you expect to be potter for such a thing, and therefore you'd be chayav? I mean, Shulchan Aruch can bring sarcastic, kind of, yeah. So in Shulchan Aruch brings both things. Hey, what? Fine, there's no shliach, but that's the point. The guy himself did it. He wounded you. He, whatever.
No, so,
yeah. He himself is liable, yeah. Now, we said Shabbos, Kadi Krat, Susi Chayev. We said that if a person says, break my jug or rip my clothing, then and he doesn't say I'm an uplifter, then the person is chayev, even though he did it at your instruction. Or a mini, the Gemara says, I have a contradiction. A Braisa says that when the pasuk describes the concept when you give something to a shomer to wash, that the shomer is chayev for various things that happen to it. the pasuk uses the expression that you give him such and such lishmer to guard. So therefore, from that we learn lishmer v'lo la'avid, it only applies if you gave it to him to guard, and not if you gave it to him to destroy. Lishmer v'lo l'kraya, he gave it to him to guard, not to rip. Lishmer v'lo l'chalak anim, and also if you gave it to him to guard, not if you told him it's something that should be given out to the anim. The reason why not given to the anim is it actually says because any oni who would come to claim it, you could tell him, well, you're not necessarily the oni who was supposed to get it. There are a lot of anim in the world. Anyway, the point is, l'chora then, if you give somebody something in order to break it, then he's potter, even if you didn't tell him I'm an asya potter. And from the Mishnah, it seems that even if you don't say, unless you say I'm an asya potter, he still is chayav. Amar Rav Huna, l'kasha, hada asya liyadeh, hada la'asya liyadeh. The difference is whether it actually came into the shomer's hands first. Meaning, in other words, so Tosfos explains, In the Mishnah, he gives it to him. He tells him, guard this thing. If you want to rip it, then you can. We can assume that he doesn't literally mean you can rip it. He just means to say, I'm not gonna be so picky with you that even if there's a tiny nick on it later, I'm gonna schlep you to Beis Din. But he doesn't mean to say literally that you can rip it. As opposed to the Braisa telling him, well, Hatzchila, he gives it to him and tells him, rip it. That's the difference. The Asi L'Yodeh, that it first came to him as something to guard, and later on the guy told him, rip it.
Changed his mind
or whatever, and told him, rip it. Where then, like Tosfos says, we can't necessarily say that rip it means, and you won't be liable. It just means that I'm not going to be so picky about it. As opposed to the Chassidah, if he gives it to him, and as he's giving it, he tells him, I'm giving this to you, and you can rip it, that's different. What are you talking about? When the pasuk says lishmo, that you gave it to him to guard, that implies you already gave it into his hand, and now you're telling him rip it. Again, according to that, you should be potter, and yet the Mishnah is saying he's chayav. No, both cases are talking about, both the Mishnah and the Braisa are talking about where the thing actually came into the shomer's hand. The loikasha, hada asu liyadeh b'teres shmira, hada asu liyadeh b'teres kriya. One is where he was originally given it as something to guard, and the other is where he was given it, l'chatchila, he was given it to him as something to rip, something to destroy. The Gemara tells a case, since we mentioned that if it's l'lo l'chalik l'anim, so the Gemara tells that if you're giving it to him in order to distribute to the poor, then he's not chayav and something happens to it. So the Gemara tells a case, how arnaka the tzedakah l'asa l'pumadisa, there was a purse full of money for tzedakah that was brought to Pumadisa. Afkader Rabbi Yosef gabi ahu gabra, Rabbi Yosef deposited it for safekeeping by a certain person. Poshaba, and he was careless with it, also gandri ganvua, and ganavim came and stole it. Chayver Rabbi Yosef, so Rabbi Yosef obligated him to pay for it. What about this bride that is meant to be distributed to the poor, then you can't hold him liable because there's no particular poor person who can claim it.
What? You can hold Rabbi Yosef liable. Does he get it to the Na'im?
No, not maybe. I don't know if you can hold Rabbi Yosef liable necessarily, but you certainly can't hold the Shomer fire. The pastor, he must have been a Shomer Sacher, because otherwise he wouldn't be. No, but he was Peshea, it doesn't really matter. It's Peshea, so it doesn't really matter whether it's Shomer Chinam or Shomer Sacher. Amalei, he says the difference is Aniyat Pumbedisa make a kayat lahu. Because the difference is in Pumbedisa over here, the poor people, there's a fixed amount that's earmarked for them. Each person, there's a certain amount that the Gabbai Tzedakah give them as a regular weekly stipend.
Each one of them?
Each one of
together?
Them. No, each one of them. The last actually, Mom and Kach L'Shabbos L'Cholachad. Each one is given for each week X amount of money. Therefore, the Havalei Mom and Shiesh Le'Tovin. So therefore, each one does have a certain claim. I have a claim on $5 from it. I have a claim on $8 from it, etc. The Lishmo, who therefore it can be called Lishmo, that he's watching this on behalf of all the different people who have a stake in it. As opposed to if it was just a generic thing, that the Gabbai Tzedakah, the Gabbai Tzedakah, no, okay, we've gotten in $1,000 and now we'll distribute it among the Aniyim as we see fit. Then there's no particular Ani who has any claim to X amount of it.
We're
talking about where it's known that because each Oni knows how much he's supposed to be getting.
A question, though.
Yeah.
It would have to be exact in that case, exactly the amount of money that the Niam would get for the entire week. Because if it would have been too much, then the extra.
Fair enough.
They would say, yeah, it goes to.
Okay, fair enough. I guess that's what it was, yeah.
Little, then,
yeah, I got it. Okay, fair enough. Hadron Alacha Chayva. Now, this perek and the next perek are going to be dealing with the dinim of Gzela. We learned about Gneva previously in Perek Merubah in the seventh perek. Then we had a Chayva, and now we have Gzela. A couple of Mephoshim take up interesting questions of why it's in this order. Why is a Chayva stuck in between? Ravina Yehonason, who's brought in Shittim Kubetzes, one of the Rishonim, has a very interesting chap on it. He says, one of the differences between a Ganav and a Gazlan, we learned back in Merubah while I was away, that a Ganav does it in secret and a Gazlan does it openly. Meaning, in other words, a Ganav, you don't know who it was who stole from you. A Gazlan, you do. A person who's the victim of a Gneva, therefore, tends to become, sometimes, such a person afterwards becomes very paranoid, very suspicious of other people. That kind of person, because he doesn't know. Anybody around could have been the thief. Therefore, he tends to lash out. He's more likely to be injuring other people in his rage. Therefore, Hachoyv will come next. Having dealt with all that, now we go to Gzela. Okay. Now, a couple of things that we're going to be dealing with in this perek are, one, if the thing that was stolen changes in value during the time from when it was stolen until its return. And number two, we're going to be dealing more with a concept that was first brought up in Merubah, the concept that a ganav or a gazlan is koina, the object that he stole, if there's an irreversible shinui in it. So, the Mishnah starts out. Well, also Yish. There is, by the way, there is a three-way machloikus between the Rishonim. When we learn the Mishnah, we'll see it. For example, when the Mishnah tells us, let's say, for example, he stole a pregnant cow and later on it gave birth, is it that the birth is considered a shinui as far as the baby? Therefore, he's kind of the baby, but not the mother. For the mother, it's not considered a shinui, and therefore he's not kind of her. Or is that that's Rashi's position? Or is it that he's kind of the mother as well, that is considered an irreversible shinui, because she's never going to be pregnant with the same fetus again. She'll become pregnant later on with another one. But the Rosh holds, that's a change, though. She was pregnant, now she's not. Later on, she becomes pregnant, that's a new pregnancy. And then you have the Rambam that holds that none of this applies anyway before Yish. Before Yish, the only reason to say that according to the Rambam, Shinui would only be after Yish. The only reason you might apply anything before Yish would be as Takonas HaShavim, is that the Chachamim want to make it easier for him to do tshuva. That instead of having to return the actual thing, he can return the monetary value. So the Mishnah starts off. Hagozel Eitzim Asam Kalim, if somebody steals wood and made them into utensils, or Ksemav Asam Begadim, where he steals wool and turns it into clothes, Mishalim Kshasek Zela, he pays according to the value of the wood or the wool when he stole it. He doesn't have to return it, he doesn't have to give back the actual Kali or the actual garment, because he was Kone at Bishinim. Gozel Parom Uberes V'yolda, if he stole a pregnant cow and it gave birth while it was still in his possession, or Rachel Te'una V'gozza, or he stole a sheep that was covered with wool and then he sheared it, V'shalom D'mei Paro Ha'imedes Leila D'mei Rachel Ha'imedes V'gozit. Then he pays the value of a cow that's about to give birth or the value of a sheep that's about to be sheared. There is, by the way, Tosfos discusses later on, does it mean what? So what does that mean? If he stole the animal in Tishrei and then gave birth in Tevis, what happens to the increase in value from Tishrei until Tevis? Does it go to the Gazlan or does it go to the original owner? There's two different Gersoyos and Tosfos over there. Whether it goes to the Gazlan or whether it goes to the owner.
It goes to the Gazlan
because it happened in his Rishus. He stole an animal which in Tishrei was pregnant. It was worth $100.
Right.
Now, by the time it comes Tevis, the fetus is bigger. It's closer to giving birth. Therefore, now the animal is worth $120. That extra $20 maybe belongs to the Gazlan because it happened in his possession. It didn't. Yeah. Okay.
It happened to something under the soul.
What?
If it became under the soul, it was born to him.
Well, we're talking about a Gazlan. He's not paying Kefil anyway, but he's paying only Karen. But no, the question would be later on, if he only has to pay the value of the animal, he's not returning the actual animal, because if he's kind of it or whatever, does he have to pay 100 or 120? Okay.
The value that increased is not his to begin with, because that value came from something that didn't belong to him.
Fine, but it didn't happen in the original owner's Rishus Sheni either. Okay, well, you know what? We'll talk about it over the next couple of blocks. Yeah. Gozel part of an Isabra Etzlevi Yolder. What happens now, another case, he steals a cow and it became pregnant while it was in his possession and it gave birth, still while it was in the Gazlan's possession. Or Rachel Benitana Etzlevi Gozel, he stole a sheep and while it was by him it grew wool and then he sheared it. Mishalim, Shatak Zela, then he pays according to the value at the time of the Gzela. So there you have another example. It increased in value while it was by him, and he gets to keep that extra value. That, while the general rule, kol gazlonim mishamim kashas gzela, all gazlonim pay according to the value of the thing at the time of the gzela, which we'll learn in the Gemara later on what that's adding.
Who is this
Mishnah? It's a Stam Mishnah. It's a Stam Mishnah. Okay. So the Chachamim said, Eitzim Vasan Kalim Ein, the implication of the Mishnah is that if he stole wood and turned it into Kalim, then it's considered an irreversible change. Shifan Loi, but if it's just that you took the wood and sanded it down, then no, that's not considered an irreversible change. Similarly, Semer Vasan Begodim Ein, Libnan Loi. Similarly, it seems from the Mishnah, if you stole wool and made it into clothing, then that's considered a Shinui Sheinichozo, an irreversible change, and you're Kone. But if you just bleached the wool, it comes off the sheep dirty, and you have to bleach it first, then that's not considered a shinui. Well, that's the question. Or a mini. I have a contradiction. Brisa says, Gozel ate in the sheep. And if a person stole wood and sanded it down, or Avodim the sitzon, or he stole stones and planed them down, again, to make them into smooth building stones. Semer v'libnon, or he stole wool and bleached it. Pishton v'nikohu, or he stole flax and cleaned it. In all those cases, Nishalim Kishaf Ezele, he pays according to the value at the time it was stolen. In other words, he's cutting the actual wool of stones or what have you. So why? According to the Mishnah, it seems he has to actually go further than that. Amar Abaya, the difference is like this. Tana didan katoni shinui dirabanan dehadra. Because you have a difference between deraisa and dirabanan.
He doesn't say the shinui.
No, hold on. The point is, in other words, like this. There is a change, for example, let's say, you can look at it like this. Okay, look here. Our Tana is mentioning a change at a drabonon level, something which can be undone, and then he's including how much more so a change deraisa, namely like this. With wood, let's say, you start out with rough planks, you can sand them down. Later on, you make those planks, you nail them together and make a table or what have you. To get the table back into the plane down planks is very easy. All you have to do is take out the nails. That's considered a shinui achoz of the briyasa. It would go back to the original state. Nevertheless, still, midrabanan, that is considered a shinui that's koine for him. That's when the Mishnah says, eitzim v'asan kalim, doesn't mean it was unplaned, doesn't mean it was rough planks of wood. It means they were already planed down, they were already sanded down. All you did is nail them together to make a table. You still, you're koine. The Brisa is mentioning another detail. If they weren't sanded down and you sanded them, that's also a shinui achoz of the briyasa, even if you didn't assemble them into a table yet. Because you can never make a sanded piece of wood back into an unsanded one. That would be able to return to the way it was originally made. That's the point. That's the point, in other words. There's two different kinds of changes. Midaraisa, the only kind of shinui that would make you be koina, would be if it's something irreversible. For example, unsanded to sanded. Midrabanan, if you made it into a keli, even if that keli could then be taken apart and restored into the original sanded down boards that you stole, you still don't have to return the actual plant. You still don't have to take apart the thing and return the actual boards of wood. You can just return the value of it. So you were kind of, that's a shinui midrabanan. Eitzim v'asan kalim. So therefore, when the Mishnah mentions wood that you turned into kalim, means the eitzim mishupin, means planed, meaning sanded down wood, or mayon yunasorim, namely boards that are sanded down and made smooth. The shinui d'hadra l'briyasa. Now that is to turn a table back into that is something you could easily do that. D'ibay mashlich. All you have to do is take it apart. Similarly, semer v'asan begodim. When the Mishnah mentioned wool that you turn into clothes, means that semer tovah. It means that you stole wool that was already spun. Again, d'shinui d'hadu l'briyasa. Again, you could return it to that state. D'boi sasalei. All you have to do is unravel the piece of clothing that you made, and you have it back into the form of the original thread that you stole.
Yeah, that's not so hard. Takes a couple of hours.
Okay. I should mention the Meiri says that this is not the halacha. He says that the Abaya is mentioning this according to his own shitta, but not necessarily is that the halacha. The halacha would actually be that is considered an irreversible change. Because, for example, if you take apart a sweater, it never is like the original. It never is really like the original wool that's yet. So then the Mishnah is implying how much more so a change which is valid on a Daraisa level, something which is irreversible, like, for example, boards that you sand. The Tana Bara, she knew your Daraisa, whereas the Tana and the Braisa is only mentioning a change which is valid on a Daraisa level. He's not mentioning the change on the Darabonim level. So therefore, he doesn't mention planks, boards that you made into a table, let's say, because he's not mentioning that kind of thing. He's focusing only on the Daraisa thing. Therefore, he only mentions boards that you sanded. Ravashi gives a different answer. Tanan didan nami shinui daraisa katani. No, actually, our Tana is also only talking about changes that are valid on a daraisa level, things which are irreversible. But the difference is, eitz and vasa and kalim, when we say in the Mishnah, wood that he made into kalim, means buchani, means that he made the wood into a pestle. He made it into the stick that you use to crush things in a mortar. Behind shifan. So that is effectively the same thing as just planing them. In other words, the point in sand, what do you do? In order to make a piece of wood into a pestle, all you have to do is sand it into a certain shape. But the key point is, Tosfos points out, what that accomplishes is two things. Number one, it's an irreversible change. But number two, it also now has a new name. Before it was called a piece of wood, now it's called a pestle. And now it's called a buchmi. That makes a difference. In other words, the Mishnah doesn't just mean that you made it into kalim, meaning, for example, you made it into a table. It could even be, for example, all you did was sand it, but by sanding it, you changed its name. You changed its function. And similarly, Tzemavasan begotim namti. Similarly, when it comes to wool that he turned into clothes, means that he made it into felt, for example. With felt, you don't even need to bleach it first. It's true, if you bleached it, you would be cutting it with that alone. But you like this, you don't even need to bleach it. However, you did change the name, Dinoshinu Delaihadar. Still, it's an irreversible change because you can never turn felt back into the original fibers that came from it.